Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta branch of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, entitled Furnishings from the Knights and Their Influence on Maltese Taste. This talk is delivered by Marquis Nicholas DePiro.
Our lecture today is Furnishing from the Knights and Their Influence on Maltese Taste. I suppose the problem here is where to start. My subject being furnishing from the Knights and their influence on Maltese taste, the impact of the arrival of the Knights carrying Grand Master Philippe de Lisle Adam and his entourage and all the other accompanying ships must have been a sight for a gaping, mostly illiterate and barefoot agricultural population. One supposes that the long-established and indeed noble Nava family resident at the Castello Amare in the main harbour area, took their chattels with them when, in 1530, they vacated what was apparently the only other formidable fortification apart from Mdina, in order to hand it over, somewhat reluctantly, to the new sovereign authority and bid farewell to Malta forever. The other noble families, mainly congregated in Mdina, would, over the years, have employed local talent to copy and recreate household embellishments, including furniture and fabric. There were not many of them, and one imagines quite a good deal of their better items would have been imported principally from Spanish Sicily, or wherever the agents who provided for them bought their goods. This might take us further afield to Spain, Portugal, and North Africa. Yes, indeed. When the Knights arrived in Malta, there was a small, functioning feudal society with modest pretensions and aspirations established locally among its lordlings, landowners, and merchants. There are well-recorded and indeed some still existing pre-Knights names of the more important families, including Gatto, Falzon, Murina, Inguanes, Castelli, Sant, Testaferrata, Marmo, Asha, Manduca, and more. The arrival of the Knights brought with it an international breath of fresh air. Perhaps... We're doing well today. Perhaps a confidence Malta had never experienced before. Now came a good and colourful Christian bundle of different nationalities, and their presence had a lot to offer little Malta, so set in her ways and traditions. The new residents were brave, ardent, aristocratic, and dedicated. Admittedly, Malta had in the past belonged to different lords, both Christian and Arab. However, present 15th century society, if not stagnant, was certainly not effusive. It was mainly concerned with the survival of the small population and its working structures. The arrival of the Knights was really momentous. These religious aristocratic cadets would slowly befriend the locals and offer employment and succor to the needy. They would build houses and some protective fortifications on the more inhabited side of the great harbor in the Birgu area. They would establish and embellish a conventual church, and being hospitallers, a hospital. And they would tidy up their administrations and try to settle down for a long, indeed, a permanent spell of time. As we all know only too well, 35 years later came the colossal threat to depose the Knights of their sovereignty. What happened is not the subject of this lecture, but perhaps the impact of the victory over the Turkish imperial fleet, the ringing of the bells all over Europe, the Te Deums would spread the prestige and popularity of those Knights of Malta. They would forever become the Knights of Malta, to be known and admired even in the farthest corners of Europe and beyond. It is after 1565, with the Knights here to stay, where our story slowly unfolds. When referring to furnishing from the night, I'm not really relating to actual pieces of furniture, but more to the impact of their form and maybe more to the qualities which have remained and been reinvented as Maltese style. There is in fact a piece of furniture, a sturdy chest, featured in the Malta Book of Records for its antiquity. It is believed that it may possibly have come over from Rhodes, which I doubt, or else that it was made locally, which might be more credible. In fact, it could have been made in Portugal, Spain, France, Germany, England, Italy. The important thing is that although it bears bulky Maltese crosses, if one were to remove them, then what have we got? I saw some very similar 16th century furniture in England. The panels looked just the same. Perhaps the carved alto rilievo angel where the doors meet might make it more French or North Italian. It is not over decorated, in fact quite a reserved piece without too much flamboyance, and without the Maltese crosses it would not occur to us to call it Maltese. On the other hand, it could well have been made in Malta after the arrival of the knights. The new, so to speak, palaces with their long enfilades of stately rooms on a piano nobile first floor, are they Maltese? We should like to think so. I am jumping the gun. The building of the new city of Valletta in the wake of the great siege victory should have a lot to tell us. When I wrote my sympathetic exploration of Valletta, I said, within the bastion fortifications, the elegance and the baroque splendor of the southernmost castle of Christianity in this part of Europe is the prestige, the grace, and the beauty of the so-called new city of Valletta. It is the relic of the chivalrous concept and an outstanding example of past European standards and princely prestige. It is today the tired but still ample manifestation of quality and luster required to establish a proud and lasting sovereign principality of the Maltese Islands. I wrote this about 15 years ago. Perhaps Valletta now does not look so tired. What with the plethora of new restaurants, shops, and the piano project started, the scene is changing. Once upon a time, the decision was taken not to expand a little village or town, not to redevelop something that was already there, but to start from the very beginning and actually build a new, complete, and splendid city. There was confidence in the air. The brave knights of the Order of St. John were the cause of European jubilation. The Turks had been stopped. The great armada of Suleiman the Magnificent had been defeated by a band of romantic, aristocratic, and armed Hospitallers. The need to arm and defend the southern flank of Christian Europe, indeed of Christendom, was a fact recognized by all her ruling princes. It was in this euphoric mood of general recognition of outstanding valor that the city to be called Valletta was conceived. The foundation stone was laid and blessed in 1566 amid pomp and pageantry. The architect was Francesco Lapparelli of Cortona, and his plans, a great grid pattern, were sophisticated to a degree and would be ably carried out and reinterpreted here and there in his absence by the Maltese architect Girolamo Cassar. Roger De Giorgio, author of A City by an Order, tells us about Cassar. I quote, "He had been chosen as the order's architect for the design of buildings, as distinct from the fortifications in connection with which he had acted as Lapparelli's assistant and which Lapparelli continued to supervise until his departure from Malta in the summer of 1570 to join the expedition to Lepanto. With them came the new Pope's very own recommendations. He was Pius V, a Dominican, a strict and saintly disciplinarian, and one of Valletta's earliest benefactors. For 232 years, Valletta served the purpose of becoming conventual capital of the Sovereign Order of St. John. The city was named after a living hero, that legendary Grand Master Jean Parisot de la Valette, galley slave for 5 years, and the inspiring strength during the significant battle we know as the Great Siege. He would be feted by Christian princes as scourge of the infidel and savior of Europe, a worthy tribute to the octogenarian's courage, tenacity, and success. The inscription on his tombstone is worth quoting in toto. Here lies La Valette, worthy of eternal honor, he who was formerly the terror of Asia and Africa and the shield of Europe, whence by his holy arms he expelled the barbarians, the first to be buried in this beloved city of which he was the founder. Without infringing on the privileges of the old capital of Indiana, to house the bishop and the cathedral, the new Knights Convent Church of St. John within the new walls would outshine anything heretofore architecturally attempted on these islands. As the years progressed and the sovereign Grand Masters and their serving knights left their bones to be buried in the great church, the splendor of their legacies grew into a dazzling relic and eventually survived as an heirloom of faith and tradition. Before I go any further, let us take a glance at what we feel might be Maltese characteristics. Where are they? Well, still in Indiana, in Sicilian-style households, and in the local humbler folklore areas, which do not concern us too much today, as influence on Maltese tastes, the good government of the aristocratic knights caused an explosion in population from perhaps as little as 15,000 people. It did not take long to get to 50,000 people. By the late 1600s, we would reach 100,000, and into the 18th century, even more, perhaps 150,000. Who were all these people? In a sense, I suppose, they were us. And they came from various parts of Europe to live in a solid and stable environment. You might soon be asking me, was there a Maltese style? And I think that whatever it was would only become partially evident into the 18th century. The people in the towns looked similar to those in most European cities, with a smattering of traders giving an occasionally oriental look. The working people in the villages looked like Sicilian peasants. The knights wore black, and in the 18th century the norm was a frock coat, a waistcoat, breeches, and buckled shoes. Most times a wig was worn, and the head was covered by a tricorn hat. There's a description by the Venetian ambassador which goes against the norm, the belief that everything always looked splendid in the city of the knights. Here's what he says. Valletta has lovely houses, straight but hilly streets. One can see certain knights about the city dressed in a manner to make one believe that they are the commonest of servants or rogues. We have another, more reliable description, which contradicts this, written during Pinto's reign by an Englishman, Bryden, fellow of the Royal Society, somebody who was not particularly disposed to be nice about the knights and was certainly not of kowtowing nature. He has this to say about Valletta towards the end of Pinto's reign. On getting offshore, we found ourselves in a new world indeed. The streets crowded with well-dressed people who have all the appearance of health and affluence. Many of the portraits and townscapes that survive confirm the second version, and it is generally known that relations were strained with Venice when the ambassador of the Most Serene Republic made his derogatory report. The opulence and splendor of Pinto's court was recorded by Tiepolo, Favre, and a string of other lesser artists. Accounts of life in the auberges talk of eating on silver plate and the Grand Master's table emulating those of the other Christian monarchs. There were fine carriages all over the city, and the sedan chair was in common use. The Grand Master liked to be carried by Turks, and it is possible that this idea became smart, and others would have copied him. Many private families owned slaves in the 18th century. They were expensive and were often shown off to their best advantage. A smart slave meant a smart master. The houses of Valletta were built with embellishments at every corner, and there's a good description of the night scene with lights at all the niches, giving a wonderful aura to the great conventual city. Even through careful examination of Maltese portraits of Testaferratas, Preziosis, Shibarasis, Mandukas, and so on, from the early 18th century, the men do not really, in my opinion, have any particular characteristics relevant to our islands to show that they were Maltese. They wear wigs, later powdered, and occasionally a sprinkling of Maltese crosses received for services rendered. Now, we come to the interesting bit. The women. The women did look recognizable as being Maltese. Why is it that when we see a portrait of a Maltese lady, we can immediately say that she is a Maltese lady? The wimple. Yes, the wimple, that delicate white veil, sometimes in the earlier part of the century worn forward, and in later years allowing quite a lot of hair to show, in other words, worn further back on the head. This triangular garment, with its pleated frill at the points, is often indicative of Malta. I maintain that I can identify a portrait of a Maltese woman of the 18th century. There is a proviso, though, a caveat. Be careful before we fall into the hole of errors. Take a good look at the portraits by Pietro Longhi. There are some Venetian ladies in his pictures which look very similar to ours. Oh dear. The upper classes in Malta in the 18th century clearly followed fashion. Yes, indeed. Lace in their portraits was accentuated, perhaps because of the abundance being locally produced. It is said some 6,000 people made lace in Malta in that period, and of course much of it had to be exported, and much of it was made by men as well as by women. One 18th century Maltese noblewoman was promised to a Sicilian gentleman. Her future father-in-law, the Duke of Montalto, writes a letter from Syracuse to the girl's grandfather in Malta. She had lost her father. It is dated November the 14th, 1749. The Duke says, "As far as head ornaments are concerned, I must confess that here Donna Giacinta, your servant," she's his wife, now I've lost my way, "declares, Donna Giacinta declares, that she is somewhat lost, because within our kingdom," we're talking Sicily, huh? "there are no master lace makers with any good taste or sense of fashion." Well, well. This is an appeal to Malta for sophistication. The Duke and Duchess eventually decide that the lace for the dowry should be made in Malta because Malta quality was better. This seriously is food for thought. The famous full-length portrait of Grand Master Emmanuel Pinto de Fonseca by the French 18th century artist Antoine Favre at St. John's has something to say about influence on Maltese taste. By the second quarter of the 18th century, Maltese taste had been drowned in the style and flamboyance of the sovereign order. Pinto's magnificent jabot around his neck is a splendor of Maltese lace. One presumes, I presume. I know we made Valenciennes, Genoese, and other European laces. And the props in the picture, the crown, the posture, the ermine, the heraldic input, the velvet, all add up to European monarchical grandeur. Maltese aspirations, Malta at her best. A few years ago, a very special Favre painting was offered for sale in Paris. The scene was a horizontal, domestic one, a bedroom scene, depicting the setting in a bedroom following sometime after the birth of a child. The location is in Malta. The wooden bedhead is highly decorated. There are 16 people in the picture, as well as two dogs and a cat. In the oil painting, the furnishings include heavy drapes, especially over the large double bed. 9 of the 10 women are wearing the classic wimple. A 10th, seated at the side of the bed, is the mamana, the wet nurse, who is not as posh as the ladies, and her headdress is simpler. This picture teaches something which we did not know before. The great Faldetta, the 18th century version, was not easy to get in and out of, and needed a second person to help the wearer to get in, to get it on and off. All the ladies' hair in the picture is powdered, except for the employee wet nurse. The pictures on the wall are mostly religious, but there are also portraits. There are 2 black servants in the picture, and this tells us something about style and pretension. Another important Jean painting by Favre, depicting 9 women and a suckling baby, includes a woman slave distracting the baby away from the mamana's nipple and offering the infant what could be a rattle. It is interesting to note the wooden baby's cot and also the fact that the hired mamana is barefoot. The Evreux Museum, France of course, multiple portraits soupe à Malte, does not really in any way contribute to the research about furnishings other than to show a table with a long tablecloth. This is an oval painting in the background. Thrones and chairs can be seen in many pictures, also tables, and the cloven hoof can sometimes be identified on our furniture. The cloven hoof, so often seen in Maltese furniture and silver. I maintain that we can actually recognize Maltese furniture. However, we must prepare to be wrong if proof of another origin is furnished. I strongly recommend that all those interested in the subject should read some of the excellent recent publications on Sicilian furniture. There truly is a lot to learn, and if one can master them, I mean if you are able to recognize a Sicilian piece, then you are close to identifying old Maltese items with conviction. There is similarity. Sometimes things seem to be identical, but sometimes a Maltese piece is a Maltese piece. I remember walking down Bond Street in London some 20 years ago. I looked into Mallet's, that most expensive of top-notch period furnishing shops, and lo and behold, what did I see? There it was, a Maltese bureau bookcase of the period of the Knights. Bun feet, late 17th or early 18th century. I entered. "Please," I said, "may I look at that beautiful piece of furniture?" It was a good splash of marquetry, but I thought perhaps not typical of Malta. We are used to differing shades of wood. There was bone in the inlay. Yet something told me that this was Maltese. I opened one of the small bureau drawers, and what did I find? It was a declaration presented by the people of Malta to Major General Sir Frederick Ponsonby, who governed Malta from 1827 to 1836. Whether this piece of furniture came out of the palace, or whether it was bought by his admirers in Malta, is something which I doubt we will ever know. The provenance, however, is very interesting. We have especially so when the piece belonged to somebody who had an interesting life. Ponsonby was known as the man who died at Waterloo on June the 18th, 1815. He had been left for dead. He lost his sword. He was disabled in both arms, was knocked to the ground by a blow from a saber, and pierced in the back up to his lungs by an enemy lancer. Two squadrons of Prussian cavalry passed over him in full trot, lifting him from the ground and then tumbling him. Finally, he was pinned to the ground by a corpse across his legs. The Duke of Wellington recommended him to become a companion of the Order of the Bath, and then later, in 1828, while governing Malta, he would be created Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George. Oh dear, all that, and we now do not even know where the beautiful Maltese bureau bookcase is, or who eventually bought it. Perhaps a researcher could have a go. I have a photograph of the piece somewhere, and the next step would be contacting Mallets. At this point, I think I would like to describe a desk from a period towards the end of the Order's sovereignty over Malta. It was made for the Sant family and is well blazoned. Stylistically, it fits into the last quarter of the 18th century. Straight lines and a bit of directoire, a bit of the sort of simplification of everything. Here we have an astonishing airiness. Gone is the Baroque and Rococo, gone is the opulence, but the comfort of confidence remains. The straight lines have replaced the heavy curves, and the marquetry is crafted with skill and without any hint of luxuriating in decadence. This is what Napoleon would eventually inherit from the regency of George IV and the latter years of the ill-fated Louis XVI. This is late Rouen, even Hompesh, a rare and compulsive development leading out of the Counter-Reformation mentality to an age of reason and smoothly sophisticated elegance. Here is a Maltese masterpiece. The desk has reached its present destination through inheritance. It is said to have started its existence with the Sant family. This can be confirmed by the coat of arms in a roundel on the star-pointed medallion at the rear on the center panel. The desk then continued its descent through the family of Manduka until it passed on to its current owners. It is illustrated in the book The Quality of Malta on page 96 and 97, if you want to see it. At this point, we really need to start asking ourselves seriously and without being prejudiced, is there such a thing as Maltese style? One supposes that what we produced during the period of the knights was more often than not actually influenced by our lords and masters and their countries of origin. We were in constant contact with France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Germany, even England, who, into the 18th century, would be sharing along with Bavaria. These countries' ships were often in our harbors, and trade was constant and regular. The one item which seems to be very much a local creation, until I am proved wrong, is the clock. A Maltese clock is not Sicilian. I used to think it was. It is not Portuguese, French, or whatever. I still can hardly believe this, and I have searched clocks in art books and on internet, and still cannot find anything which we could muddle up with a Maltese clock. I am still a bit skeptical about this, but I hope that the Maltese clock remains really ours. It is so decorative and so nostalgically indigenous. Let us now move forward into the 19th and early 20th century and try to find out if there are any very definite local characteristics. We are still international. We are building Baroque, a little Gothic, pseudo-Indian follies, fountains, belvederes, and so on. What I find exciting here is that with the British in Malta, we are consciously or unconsciously becoming more Maltese. What I'm trying to say is that what is left of us, that conglomeration of mixed nationalities under the Knights, is and will start to psychologically amalgamate into one nation as a subject colony of another state, and not as before with a choice of affiliations to any of the eight lungs of the Order of St. John in Malta. The prosperity of the growing British Empire would soon start showing locally. There were jobs and services functioned reasonably well. There would be schools, and the middle or business class would grow considerably. Perhaps more people could afford things than they could previously. Our churches, especially the parishes, would be further embellished, and ambitious projects would involve one parish competing with another. Jewelry was being worn by more humbler folk, and filigree became plentiful, and became Maltese filigree. The British were not afraid that the Knights might repossess Malta, and they did not mind the copious use of the Maltese cross. This wonderful symbol was liberalized and would become a symbol of Maltese craft and a decoration. This said, Malta was not the only place producing filigree. Our craftsmen were excellent, but they rarely signed their earrings, rings, and large Maltese crosses. When they included the symbol into the design, then we felt we had a Maltese piece. In trying to capture new markets, the Maltese cross brooch was sometimes composed of thistles for the Scots or Tudor roses for the English. With lace, however, we have a different situation. The lace makers, who had diminished after the fall of the Knights, would enjoy a renaissance and reach new heights of perfections, which, it is arguable, had not been reached even during the period of the Order of Malta. This is a very contentious statement, but it is well worth investigating. Today, with a vibrant and enthusiastic number of lace makers, properly advised by societies and clubs, as well as by the academically trained Consigliazzo Pardi involved with the University of Malta, students can be assured of good training. We still have not answered the question. Can Maltese lace be identified? Well, I believe a lot of it can. Under the British, it became essentially Maltese. The standard had to be so high, not cottagey lace, but splendor, to be worn by Queen Victoria and the royal princesses, by the aristocrats and the viceroy's lady. From this period, there's a great deal of surviving evidence, and I strongly believe that Maltese lace from the 19th century is nearly always positively recognizable. Perhaps the most identifying Maltese garment is a cape. It has been mentioned in pre-19th century times as the faldetta, and this appears in old wills and diaries dating back to the 16th century. It was sometimes expensively embellished. Perhaps this was not the Ornella we know now. It was really in the 19th century that this outer garment established itself with a great sweep of stiffening over the head of the wearer. This later version of the faldetta, which we now call the Ornella, became so unquestionably identifiable as being Maltese that now it only takes a glance at a painting or an old photograph to recognize it as being completely us, completely local. In summing up this lecture, furnishing from the Knights and their influence on Maltese taste, we must always keep in mind the fact that we successfully and for a long time housed that great multilingual international order of St. John, indeed for more than 250 years. With it came a sophisticated melee of European haute culture, craft, silver, fashion, propped up by a great wealth and a legendary reputation. Our fast-growing population developed in this atmosphere. There was luster, blazon, and education at many levels, from the senior professions in the church, in medicine and law, to the arts and the humbler crafts, our little islands were enhanced with pretension, sophistication, and even power. Of course, out of all this, inevitably, there would be the flowering of encouragement and the virtuosity and inventiveness of confidence. Under the knights, we developed as a sovereign state. We were respected. We were, as a group, international by blood, but one motivated and indeed Christian European people. We had carriages, sedan chairs, lovely churches, masters of the mint, a prince, magnificent silver, palaces, local furniture, shipbuilding, and our very own distinctive and elegant dicer. We were lace makers, jewelers, tailors, farmers, architects, doctors, decorators, and all the rest of it. And the more we flourished, the more European we became. The British period affected us and gave us the useful English language. It was, however, the period of the knights which molded us, changed us, gave us importance and wide horizons, internationalized our taste, and, give or take a bit, made us more or less what we are.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta branch of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, entitled Furnishings from the Knights and Their Influence on Maltese Taste. This talk was delivered by Marquis Nicholas de Piro.